My name is Bill Spakowski, and I've spent 10 years in the middle of my career as a public sector planner working in comprehensive planning and zoning in Florida. And in doing that, I've learned a lot about how codes are, how codes work, how they don't work, why they don't work, what happens to efforts to improve them. And also, I've gained a certain sympathy for what it's like when the planner who's making his career in a particular city or town faces the consultants that come in with great new ideas and explain them to the world and then leave. And then the planners who are left behind have to figure out how to make it work. So I think that informs a lot of my work with new urbanism and form-based codes, thinking ahead and wanting to be the person who's now on the consulting side who makes it easy for those local governments rather than making it difficult for them. You know, at its most basic, a form-based code should be just what we do for planning and code writing anywhere. We're just trying to carry out a physical plan for a place. And why is that complicated? Because the reality is it is complicated in different ways. And I think part of it is that many of the people who staff government agencies don't have a background in physical planning. And that's something that the planning schools in the 70s and 80s thought was an advance, getting beyond physical planning, doing socioeconomic planning and equity planning and affordable housing planning and environmental planning, often at the cost of basic physical planning. My own background before I worked in government was in the construction trades and in residential design, and so I didn't have that same handicap or benefit of that kind of education. Which made me useful in the planning department, and I think it's, again, informs part of what I do today. So, you know, from the purpose of the code writer, whether that person is a city or city staff person, or is a member of the consulting team, or is the urban design planners, the goal is simply to start with the, we assume, elegant urban design plan, and find a way to create a code that makes that work on a day-to-day basis for the people who implement those plans for the local government. Now, there's two basic fundamental approaches right at this point. One is to create a separate code, and I think Chad was describing the smart code as I came in, and also many of the California form-based codes that are really their own review process, their own complete integrated code with sign standards and parking standards and stormwater standards. It's basically a complete different package. And that's done a lot of places. Other places, more places, actually don't create such a complete separate code, but actually integrate the new form-based code into the regulatory structure that's already in place. Pros and cons of each different way. But I'm going to talk more about the codes today where we're trying to integrate them in, because in Florida we're required to do integrated land development codes. We're not supposed to have an ordinance here and subdivision regulations there and a sign ordinance there. By state law, we're supposed to have everything in a single code, everything tightly integrated. Not always done, but that is the goal in the state law. I saw this cartoon first in the late 70s when I was on the other side before I worked for government, and I thought, thank God, the planners do have a sense of humor. They see it. This is all insane. You know, the conglomeration of rules that affect the design of any, even something as simple as a house, were often astounding and inexplicable. And when those annoying people like me say, but why do we have that rule? I began to discover that the answer often was, we don't know, but it's the rule and it's our job to enforce it. What a terrible way to do planning. But the fix is not easy. I mean, the form-based code has these characteristics. As different as all form-based codes are, they nearly all have these particular characteristics. Conventional zoning world, the world that's in place and has been functioning up until the day that we decide we need to do something dramatically better, has different terms, different concepts. Maybe they're well integrated, maybe they're not. But they're very different, and it's the figuring out how to make the link that's a real challenge. and can be a great, great asset to figure out how to do this, a great asset in getting your plans carried out. Now, code writing, form-based code or any other code writing, can begin years after the planning process is done, but it's a real shame for it to wait years, not only because there's lost time, but there's lost momentum. There's nothing like a community-wide charrette and enthusiasm for a better way of doing things to propel you into the next step of getting the code adopted. So definitely it's best to get the code started. Not necessarily all the detailed work and writing and crossing of T's and all, but the basic concept, because if the plan itself is written and designed in such a way that it supports the new regulations, it makes the new regulations more easily adopted, more easily defended in court. I'm often the one who has to do this, and it is bad news to take all that and go through it and try and understand it. And what I found, almost invariably, is after doing this and then going in and meeting with the zoning administrator and the planning director, that I know the code way better than they do. Because the way the codes are administered, everybody reviews a certain section. Everybody knows a little piece of that code. And very few people, if anybody in the jurisdiction, knows it all. And interestingly, the people who know it all usually are the civil engineers who have to take projects through the approval process. They often know it better than anybody else. But in order to modify, reform, overthrow the system, you need to understand what the system is in place and which parts of it are there for a good reason and which parts are just there because they're there and they can be easily eliminated. Now, for the codes that aren't completely freestanding, like the smart code or like the specific plan codes from California, for those that tend to be more integrated with the regulatory system, they can be roughly broken into three groups. And I'm going to talk a little bit about each one and give an example or two of each one. And you really can't begin to write a form-based code until you know where it fits in this system. Because how you write the words, how the diagrams are created, the level of detail in the regulating plan differs depending on how the code is going to be used. Interestingly, most codes are mandatory. We talk a lot about optional codes or parallel codes, and I will talk about it this morning. But by and large, most form-based codes are mandatory. They're just the law. A lot of times practitioners have this terrible fear that the local governments would never have the nerve to make their codes mandatory. The truth is, they do it all the time, and they do it without a thought, and they do it even when they're heading in the wrong direction. So it's really not that much of an imposition. I always recommend we start assuming that a code ought to be mandatory, and if this is the right thing to do, it ought to be mandatory. And then there's several fallback positions for different reasons. So when you do that, you actually are replacing parts of the existing code, in some cases actually repealing whole sections of the existing code. And that's when you really need to understand the interrelationship between the parts of the code. Why rewrite a sign ordinance if the existing sign code works fine? If the existing sign code is terrible, then get rid of it. But you need to understand very clearly how yours is better and why it's better and more appropriate. Now, the mandatory form-based codes, a lot of them actually just completely replace existing zoning districts. Some of them, for fear of the rezoning process, a government fears the rezoning process when they initiate the rezoning the same way developers do. It's that notice to every neighbor within 350 feet that terrifies them just as much as anybody else. So often there'll be methods of adding this new code but avoiding that step of rezoning, which means the old regulations stay in place and now we have the new regulations that are mandatory. And imagine trying to explain that at the zoning counter to somebody who wants to open a restaurant, why one set of regulations should be ignored and the other has to be followed. I'm just going to give one example of the mandatory code, even though this is the most common type. The city of Sarasota, Florida, DPZ did a master plan there about 5 or so years ago for the downtown area. It might be 500 or 800 acres. I don't know exactly. This was the city zoning map. 28 zoning districts in the downtown area alone. Not because it really needed 28, but because It just happened that way through the years. The easiest way to solve a problem is to create a little overlay or create one new zoning district or one new PUD and never look at the fact that you now have lost, or you begin bit by bit to lose the legibility of your plan for downtown. When the when this plan got implemented, this became the zoning map for four zoning districts. Now, there's a lot more detail that I'll show you in a minute, because in fact, form-based codes tend to be quite prescriptive and have more detail than conventional zoning, but it's meaningful detail rather than agglomeration of stuff from the past. Downtown Bayfront, downtown core, downtown edge, and downtown neighborhood. Now, in addition to, and so the city adopted these four zoning districts, they did rezone in one fell swoop, not without a lot of rancor, rezone the entire downtown area to these new districts. In addition, this code has two regulating plans that are actually adopted into the zoning ordinance. Regulating plans are just maps that show a higher level of detail on how to implement the plan. One of these is the grid of primary streets, which have the highest level of pedestrian-oriented standards. And then they had a second regulating plan showing mandatory and optional retail frontages. So that basically is it. The rest of this code, based on the smart code template of about 4 or 5 years ago, somewhat different than the current one, basically use those three maps. And interestingly, on the city website, and at the end I'll give you the link if any want to look at these, is this document that the city published explaining the ways that they modified the earlier version of the smart code into their zoning ordinance. And it's very interesting which things they felt were important enough to change, what they felt it was important to clarify. And this code has, you know, its success is still to be judged, but basically these modifications were the sensible kind of things you have to do to take a model code and make it actually work for your precise purposes. The second major type of codes are the optional or parallel codes. Compliance is voluntary, which makes these codes easier to adopt because you're giving people a second choice. You're giving landowners a second choice on how to do things, and if they don't like it, they don't need to do it. And that's greatly politically easier. So because it's, like I say, it's optional, it supplements the code. It doesn't repeal anything in the code. It just gives an alternate path. And typically, this kind of code will span existing zoning districts rather than just replacing one. Sometimes an optional code like this can actually cover the entire city, as Montgomery has done on their optional portion of their smart code. Probably the best-known example of the optional parallel code is the Columbia Pike Code in Arlington County, Virginia. And this is just a copy of their illustrative plan for portions of Columbia Pike that had the highest potential for redevelopment in higher intensities than the existing pattern. And the regulating plan was derived from that illustrative plan the way they always are. The regulating plan is the schematic drawing showing the most important points about how within the area, the area is differentiated by either pedestrian character, building height, location of buildings on the lots. And so this regulating plan goes into the separate article of the Arlington County Code. It's way off at the back, but people can choose to use it if they want. And importantly, the landowner chooses and doesn't have to have anybody ratify that choice through the rezoning process. That's a key factor here. So if there's an optional code with all these new rules, why would developers choose to do it? Well, it really depends on the existing rules. In Arlington County, there's a tortuous approval process with lots of community meetings, involves citizenry, very fearful of new development, probably rightly so given a lot of what's happened up there. But by eliminating the rezoning stage, it makes this particular zone much more desirable. And there are density bonuses as well, which in the D.C. area is very important. Now, the third major kind are the floating zone codes. And the term floating zones, an old term from zoning term from the 50s, and dying to find something, a more descriptive way to describe it. I've heard it described recently as a template code, which actually is an interesting way to describe it for reasons I'll mention in a minute. But again, this kind of code is optional, not forced on a landowner. So therefore, it supplements the code. But how it's different from the optional parallel codes is the landowner requests it, but in this case, he has to go through the rezoning process. Public hearings, legislative discretion, roomfuls of people who might be opposed to a project, basically a lot more risk for the developer than optional or parallel code. On the other hand, elected officials, including the very best of them, are much more comfortable with a far-reaching new code if they're going to see the finished product. There's a couple examples I want to have. The original granddaddy of the floating zone codes was the Miami-Dade County Code adopted in 1991, written by DPZ and others, and still on the books today. It's like a PUD district. It's a negotiated with the county. You bring in a very detailed site plan of how you want to develop, and if you meet all the criteria, you might get approved. Again, you might not. And so these codes actually have been adopted all around the country, many of them virtual verbatim reproductions of this one, and also many other versions, and haven't had as much success as their proponents have hoped. And I think the rezoning portion of it is one of the big things that caused a lot of fear. This code also was the one of the early poster codes that was actually adopted by a local government, where the idea was, instead of having a thick book with post-it notes on every page, you would actually be able to see the structure of the code on one, admittedly, very large sheet of paper. And this is what it looked like, and the sort of the downside of this is sort of obvious, that when you have anything presented in a matrix, the whichever box has the most text in it controls the size of the matrix, and then pretty soon you're at four point fonts, and it really makes it difficult. But the biggest problem with this format, though, is if your code is not published by the local government, if it's published by one of the code codification services, like this one by Municipal Code Corporation, forget your format. They fit it in their format. And so forget all that nice graphic presentation where you can see it all on one page. This is what it looks like. And then the graphics are missing, misplaced, linked, poor scans. So really thinking ahead of how the code's going to be published is pretty important. The other example I want to show you is actually a work in progress, not adopted, I don't believe, for another month or two. Also in Sarasota County, but this is in the unincorporated county, not the city. And this is for sites that are abandoned gray fields, abandoned shopping centers in Southwest Florida, abandoned mobile home parks that might be at the intersection of two arterial roads, might be on barrier islands, all kinds of places where the land is tremendously valuable. And the county understands that these are all along their major future transit corridors that need to be used more intensely, but they've had a difficult time in figuring out how to do a code that encourages what they want without opening the door so wide that they'll get the kind of development coming through the process that they never anticipated and wouldn't approve. This particular, we just picked a sample site on this and actually did an illustrative plan, new urbanist illustrative plan, that carries out the principles that are in this proposed ordinance, the design principles, basically your basic new urbanism, but applied to dense mixed-use infill in a coastal community. And then actually showed, this is where the template idea comes in, showed developers how, if this were their property and this were the plan that they wanted to propose, how they would bring that through this single rezoning hearing in a way that doesn't tie them down too much on details, but is pretty darn specific about the most important points of this development, because again, the commissioners have to face the neighbors and everybody else. So actually in the ordinance is actually the sample regulating plan that's tremendously detailed, much more detailed than regulating plans generally are in municipal form-based codes, more like the regulating plan that a developer would have created for him or her to actually do a development, actually down to what kind of building will appear on each lot. And the reason that this kind of regulating plan can fit in this code is because the developer who prepares this plan and brings it forward, if it were the local government saying, this is our plan for your area, it wouldn't be this specific. So that regulating plan shows the three most fundamental things about how this development will take place. Relative intensity by transect zone. So the gray shaded area, the gray hatched area here on this particular site shows the tallest buildings, the core transect zone there. We can't call it the center because Sarasota County has a different use for that term. Most of these areas would be the general transect zone, some commercial uses, all kinds of residential uses, multifamily and attached primarily. And then something called an edge transect zone that's used here a little differently than in most new urbanist projects. These are the areas where there's an existing stable neighborhood next door who's going to fight this project to death if what's up next to them isn't not too out of scale with what they already have. And so this transect zone is basically designed to be a bridge instead of walls and gates, to be a bridge of development of generally similar intensity or not too much higher intensity, and then preserve areas that won't be developed at all. So that's one thing that's on each regulating plan. The second is lot types, which is another way of saying building type. But what we're actually doing here is regulating the land, and what kind of building can be built on that. So in the core transect zone, for instance, you're allowed to have a, what's called here a pedestal building up to 10 stories, big box or parking garage or cinema with a liner building around it. It has, it's called a separate lot type. So if you designate this lot type on your regulating plan, you then are allowed to have a slightly larger block size to provide the structured parking or the larger box, but it will be completely hidden. And you know, altogether, most of the rest of these are pretty standard things you would expect. But you see on the left of this drawing, this little box that says core in general, that just indicates that this particular lot type can fit in either of those two transect zones. So that's the rest of those. And there's one... civic space types. These are the parks, greens, neighborhood areas. Now, the link in this code between the new urbanist master plan and the world of zoning is this table here. You can't read it here, but what it has is all the lot types in a grid down the left side, those 14 lot types. And across the top are all the zoning stuff that somebody has to check. I think 10 years from now, somebody buys one of these lots, wants to go ahead and build their building, or wants to tear a building down and change it. What are the rules that somebody has to check? What are the setbacks? What are the maximum heights? Can you build an accessory dwelling unit? Yes, in nearly every case. Where are the major pedestrian zones where the building should fill most of the frontage? So this is the translation between zoning and new urbanism. Actually, there's a second table just like it that has, again, the lot types down the left and the permitted uses across the top using the language that the county already uses. And the third major part is just the street types, boulevards, avenues, using new urbanist terms. And one clear statement at the beginning of these that the standards shown here supersede those found elsewhere in the code. That key sentence that makes these override the public works standards designed for major traffic movement. County traffic engineers almost on board, still not quite there, but we're getting close. So again, these are the types, and somebody's allowed to propose, a developer's allowed to propose a different lot type or a different street type, but they're sort of compared to these. They all have street trees and sidewalks on both sides and things that seem very normal here, but in Southwest Florida are not. So that's how that is. Last, this is again the regulating plan that shows these three types. We don't show the normal plan development process in this county actually shows dumpsters and fully engineered everything rather than a schematic plan. So actually this is less specific, if you can believe it, than what people normally do. Now the process of working with the city staff on this is two-way. You know, it's learning how their code works, learning what's not enforced that's written there, or what's not written there but is enforced, and why. And it's a great chance to, while you're figuring out the code, to educate the staff people about what you're trying to accomplish, how you can solve problems that they've seen with the codes but maybe have never had the nerve or political clout to change. At the same time, it's a great chance to teach the staff people about the principles of new urbanism, give them the confidence and resources so that when this code is turned over to them, they'll understand the reason that the code is the way it is. And when somebody says, why is it that way, they'll remember the conversation and read the plan and be able to go back to it and suddenly feel good about their job rather than just being a bureaucrat. For those who are interested in a shameless plug here for a training program on form-based codes, in the back of the room, as you go out, there's a flyer you can pick up if you're interested in learning more than you'd ever want to know about form-based codes. I have here the URLs for these codes, but the lower URL, which is my website, has the PDF of these slides that has all the links. This also will be posted to the CNU toolkit for this Congress. So if any of these particular items are of interest to you, you'll be able to not have to rely on your notes or your memory and go ahead, because all these are online and can be easily accessed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bill. I just wanted to mention, while we're firing Alan's presentation up here, that the person who had first intended to organize this session is our dear friend Paul Crawford, who is battling a very difficult malady, and our hearts and prayers are with him. He is the spirit of this presentation, and I took over the organizing functions, and Bill took over the presentation of how you tie design to codes that Paul is so brilliant at presenting.
My perspective on form-based code practice is really informed by a number of years, probably about 7 years, working as a consultant, working for Mullenpaizoides, writing form-based codes for municipalities and developers. And for the past 18 months, I've been in a new role as the City of Glendale's urban designer in the planning department. And so my presentation is a little bit of a sort of what I did on my summer vacation, kind of, lessons learned from going from the side of writing codes as a consultant and now having to implement them, and some kind of thoughts about what that might mean. I think one of the things is it's important to look at the use of form-based codes, and there are really two different kinds of uses that I've seen. The first is that many of the municipalities that I worked for as a consultant had form-based codes as a substitute for a formal design review process. They're building in a lot of these extra design controls because they didn't have a design review process and they needed to have tighter design control. The other option, which is the case in Glendale, is that any kind of code, form-based code that we would pursue, is a supplement to a design review process. In Glendale, any building over, or addition to a building over 500 square feet goes to a mandatory discretionary design review process, which, as you might imagine, is a little bit unwieldy to administer and, has completely unpredictable results. So the form-based code is, tries to put a little bit of a box around that kind of process. And I think understanding which sort of design review process you're going to have is important to acknowledge when you're writing the code and how you would ultimately use it. And that leads to two kind of considerations that I want to try and illustrate with my talk. The first is to ask, how does the code, in terms of its structure and its language, facilitate staff review, whether that's written through staff reports to a design review body, or whether staff actually has to make findings that projects are in compliance with the code. And the second point is that I think the code does need to have policy language that describes the design intentions of the code. And this suggests that there may need to be some sort of guideline-y type language in the code. A lot of time, the reason for having a form-based code is to basically throw away guidelines. But I think there is a place for that kind of policy language that describes the intention of the code. So I want to illustrate this with two different kind of planning areas, form-based codes. The first is for the city of Montclair in California, which is a form-based specific plan and code that I helped author with Mullenpaizoides and with Paul Crawford and a number of other new urbanist consultants. A little bit of background. Montclair is a typical post-war suburb on the eastern edge of Los Angeles. It has the commuter rail, which is the blue line there, connects it to into downtown Los Angeles, and the gold line light rail that goes to Pasadena will eventually be extended with a stop in Montclair. It's the same stop where the Metrolink commuter rail is, and then eventually onto the Ontario International Airport. This is a kind of zoom in of the site. We were asked to look at the area surrounding the train station. As you can see, number two is a big regional shopping mall. And basically the site surrounding this, currently one train station, eventually two train stations, as you can see from the aerial photograph, is mostly regional shopping mall, big box retail, parking lots, and completely vacant parcels. This is right as you get off the train station. This is the street that takes you down to the mall, in which we imagined, you know, a new kind of plaza surrounding the train station. And instead of going into a parking lot at the mall, there'd actually be a proper front door and pedestrian-oriented street. So through a series of workshops, we worked up a basic illustrative plan that described a sort of transit village surrounding the Metrolink station with connections to pedestrian connections to the front door of the mall. And that was basically predicated on subdividing these parcels and these parking lots into a smaller pattern of streets and squares, which then led to the regulating plan or your basic sort of zoning map, in which we organized we basically had three different kind of transect zones. There was the town center, which is the kind of most intense between the train station and the shopping mall, and then two different kind of intensities of residential depending on where you were in the plan area. One of the things that we did, we had to describe, is how would you actually implement this code, how would you use it? And so what we developed at Moulin Paisotti's was this chart, and Tony Perez, who's in the room, actually deserves a lot of credit for kind of coming up with this flowchart of how to use the standards in the form-based code. And basically what this flowchart shows is three different kinds of typical developments and how the code standards would apply, which ones you'd actually have to pay attention to. So on the left is basically a change of use in an existing building. In the middle is a new building. And then on the right, which uses the most code standards, is development of more than roughly 2 acres that has to go through also subdivisions standards. And so we describe this most intense one because in the case of Montclair, most of the properties were well over 2 acres and would be subject to this more intense kind of use of the code. So we said it's really the first thing you have to do is, you know, as a developer, potential developer, is identify the zone and parcel that you have in the regulating plan. So this is pretty much what you would do with any sort of zoning map. You find out what zone you're in. And then there were some statements about kind of what the intentions of that zone were. And then the second question is to ask, is the proposed use allowed in that particular zone? In which case, you can consult a use table that says yes or no, or it's conditionally permitted. This is actually pretty important because I think in form-based codes, we always emphasize it's about form, it's about design, but uses, and oh yeah, we'll take care of uses. But in fact, I think for most developers who are sort of speculating or looking at land, the question of whether I can put a flower shop there or not is like the first question in their mind, because if the answer is no, they're going to go away and not pay attention to any of the design standards. So Paul Crawford has in fact actually done a lot of the work in sort of refining use tables, so you're not describing every possible use under the sun, but just general categories of uses. Then for larger developments, as I said, between over 1.8 to 2 acres in size, subdivision standards then apply, and this gets into the sort of definition of, you know, how big blocks should be, their maximum size, how you would introduce new streets, what those should look like, and how you would then divide that into smaller lots to make smaller buildings rather than one huge project. Then you could apply the urban standards for that zone to your particular project, and that deals with all the basic stuff of building placement, setbacks, building height, location of parking, and that sort of stuff. Finally, then you would get into the frontage types, which we've kind of described in great detail, those that apply, and then the other kind of applicable design standards, such as building type standards per zone. And then in the case of North Montclair, we actually developed an architectural style guidelines, so that was also the kind of final sort of piece of the code you had to pay attention to as you worked up your development proposal. And then, of course, you would then prepare and submit your application to the city with whatever sort of extra fees they tacked onto for this project. Now, Montclair does not have a design review process, and so this is a case where the intent of the code and a lot of this extra kind of language was designed to sort of substitute a design review process. And what ended up happening as we worked this up is they decided, actually, we want to formalize in the specific plan an external design review. And so, actually, after I left Mullumpy Zoides, the city contacted me and said, would you sort of serve as our independent design review and critique projects using the code for us? So I said yes. And so the first project that came in is outlined here in this little red box. It was a project designed for Lang Urban by William Heselmach Architects. As you can see on the right, the existing site is basically a gravel pit. On the bottom left was the sketch that we did for the illustrative plan, and at the top is the conceptual site plan that Lang Urban walked in with. This was actually a useful kind of comparison to sort of say, this is what the kind of design intent of the code was, or the plan, and how we kind of compare with it. If you take a close look at it, you'll see they've kind of shifted some of the streets around. You know, they don't exactly have the same pattern of building types. But by and large, the general intent is there. They kind of hit most of the key moves. So this is kind of what they imagined, where, you know, there's this kind of very wide road with the gravel pit. There's going to be live-work townhouse-style lofts facing a street with a median. This is the site plan they came in with. The existing road is at the bottom, Arrow Highway. All the other roads are all new introductions into the site. Arrow Highway is kind of a major arterial. Another case where they then showed how they were complying the proposed streets that they had, were suggesting, how those compared with the streets that were put into the specific plan. So if you take a close look at this, you'll see that, you know, they've made some adjustments to the numerical dimensions. By and large, they're pretty close. The curb-to-curb dimensions are more often than not the same. They've made some adjustments in the right-of-way to have wider sidewalks in some cases, or, you know, wider parking areas. So in my review of this project, one of the things I said they really needed to pay attention to was the definition of how they were defining the different kinds of open spaces. So the kind of aqua green is the public space, what was sort of designed to be public streets, and that this space needed to be distinguished from the medium green, which is sort of kind of community green space, versus the kind of lighter grass-colored green, which is the green that's associated with courtyards for a small cluster of units. So in terms of how they landscaped this project, how the pavement was taken care of, I said it was important that they actually distinguish these different kinds of streets. And then in terms of the architecture, this was what was proposed. These are live-work lofts, so there's a live-work space. The workspace is on the ground floor with residential above and kind of tuck-in parking behind. These live-work lofts were proposed on the kind of perimeter of the project in that particular architectural style in the buildings you see here in purple, you know, with this little tower effect sort of marking the entrance to the project in a particularly nice way. The rest of the project was proposed as various forms of kind of two, three-story townhouse units arranged either in row house configurations or in courthouse configurations, and they had a variety of different sorts of styles. So this style was where these orange buildings are located. There was another style where the red buildings are located, and then another kind of pattern of styles located elsewhere. Now, what was important is that each one of these individual buildings, as they were designed, met pretty much all the basics.